Uganda wraps up a presidential election that no one really thinks was free or fair.
The treatment of the opposition, everything that has happened, has been quite shocking. Well, I have to say, no surprises here.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Authorities in India are trying to hunt down a single elephant that's killed almost 24 people.
They're using drones, and they've asked experts from neighboring states to help. But in the meantime, they're asking people to please stay indoors at night, avoid the forests.
We'll hear what it's like to be on the front lines of fighting wildfire in Australia and how this Chinese-American woman united her ambition with her roots on the Lower East Side of Manhattan.
That's where I found love with food, flavor, and freshness. That was the community that raised me.
All that and more coming up on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. In Uganda, Yoweri Museveni looks likely to extend his 40-year rule with another term in office. Provisional results from Thursday's vote show him well ahead of the main opposition candidate. This election has been marred by voting delays and allegations of ballot stuffing, security concerns, and internet blackouts. Ebenezer Obadare is an African Studies Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. I asked him if this was a fair election.
It wasn't a fair election. Nobody expected it to be a fair election. Even the leading candidate, Bobi Wine, I'm sure he fully expected President Museveni to win. So the treatment of the opposition, everything that has happened, has been quite shocking. But I have to say, no surprises here.
Yeah. So tell me more about what has happened and how the opposition has been treated.
So if you listen to, I'm referring to a couple of statements, one by the United Nations Human Rights Agency, and I believe that was another one by Amnesty International. Both statements made explicit references to the political situation in the country, specifically with respect to the treatment of the media, internet blackout, the fact that some opposition figures were rounded up and police killed, and I think about 10 people. So if you are on the other side of the aisle, watching this, and you're one of the people trying to upstage President Museveni, it's been a very rough spell.
It's been a very rough spell, you say.
Yes.
So tell me more about Bobi Wine as the main opposition figure. He ran against Museveni in the last election and did not win and said, you know, the election was rigged. What was the message that he brought to voters this time around?
I think this time around, he's calling this what he calls a protest vote, which sort of tells you everything you need to know about this. Mr. Wine is an entertainer. I think his platform has been built around opposition to the regime. He wants to stamp out corruption. He argues rightly that under the leadership of President Museveni, that the economy has been arrested, things have stalled, and that the country needs an infusion of new energy, especially among young people. And at the age of, I think he's 43. Yeah. And he has projected himself as the right person to do that. And young people across the country have rallied around him. Unfortunately, I think what they're up against, state power, under the thumb of a very strong 81-year-old, I think it's going to be almost impossible to dislodge.
So what will this mean for Ugandans for the next 5 years?
This political situation is quite grim. Keep in mind two things. One is that President Museveni is not only holding on to power, he's been grooming his own son, who is a general in the Ugandan army, to succeed him. That's number one.
He's the head of the military, so obviously a powerful person to be grooming to be the next leader.
Exactly. So once the Museveni the elder leaves, you're stuck with Museveni the son if things go to plan for him. It's also the Ugandan situation alerts us to broader trends in Africa. So Mr. Museveni is not the only African leader who has held on to power for decades. So there's Paul Biya in Cameroon, who recently won another election. There is Ouattara in Cote d'Ivoire. There is Nguema in Equatorial Guinea. There is next door to Musa Museveni, there is Paul Kagame in Rwanda. So you have these old men who have held on to power for decades who are refusing to vacate. And once you have is you have institutions that have ossified, and you have a system that is basically literally under arrest. And it makes young people difficult to think of themselves and their future in a very positive way.
Hmm. You've mentioned the economy and, you know, this desire for change among young people. What is, you know, what is day-to-day life like in Uganda right now, you know, after 40 years of Museveni rule?
Yeah, if you ask President Museveni, things have never been better. But of course, he will say that. But experience tells us, and this is not just about Africa, this is about the whole of the world, that once you have someone in office who's been there for so long, they manage to put in place structures that basically become very, very reactionary. So the whole project becomes about preserving power rather than advancing economic growth and opening up opportunity for young people. So it's a classic case. It's just being reproduced in this very instance in Uganda.
Has the opposition under Bobi Wine come out and said anything so far now that what about half of polling places are reporting results?
So this is part of the problem. Remember, there has been no formal declaration. We know President Museveni is going to win. I mean, 75% of vote counted is won, I think, from about 60% of polling stations. Bobi Wine is trailing by about 21 points. It's going to be President Museveni. Expect two things to happen. Expect Bobi Wine and his platform and his supporters to reject the outcome of the election and to protest. But at the same time, expect what happened the last time, back in 2021. The authorities are going to clamp down on protests, and most likely Bobi Wine is going to come under house arrest again.
Mm. Under such long odds, you know, it's always interesting to see people still standing for election, even when the result is a foregone conclusion. I'm wondering if that tells you anything or is any sort of reason for hope that change might be possible at some point in Uganda?
Absolutely. I've never given up hope. And I'm glad you mentioned this because you're asking us to think here about the resilience of the Ugandan people. And it's something that I think should be front and center. But the other thing is, if you look at the broader trend in Africa, you actually have people showing hope in the idea of governance by popular consent. And in this year, at least 10 countries are expected to schedule national level polls of some sort. So the hope surge is there. The hope, the optimism is there. The will is there. People, especially young people, want to have elections. They don't want strong men like Mr. Museveni. So even if, as we expect, Bobi Wine does not win this election, it's not the end. The fervor for change is not going to die overnight. And this story is by no means over.
Ebenezer Obodare is an African Studies Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. Since the start of the new year, more than 20 people in the Indian state of Jharkhand have been killed in elephant attacks. It's thought one elephant is responsible for all of the deaths. These deaths come at a time of growing human-elephant conflict in India, and residents are on high alert. Journalist Namrata Kalashalam has been following the story closely. Namrata, what more do we know about what has happened?
Well, it's a pretty frightening situation on the ground. The victims in Jharkhand include a man in his mid-30s. There were a number of young children and seniors who were killed. And it's all happening in a pretty poor area where people don't have a lot of resources. The elephant is most likely a young male that's become separated from its mother and might be trying to find its herd. So that also is complicating the situation on the ground.
How are the authorities responding?
There's just been a huge push to find this elephant. 100 officials or so are looking for the animal throughout the forest, but it's moving really rapidly, around 18 miles a day, and its behavior is erratic, so it's not really clear where it's going next. And it's also really not easy to capture an elephant. Authorities have tried to tranquilize it three different times, but it keeps on managing to escape them. In the meantime, they're asking people to please stay indoors at night, avoid the forest.
So this all sounds so wild from here in the U.S., where we do not have this threat of wild elephants. How unusual is what is happening right now there?
It's not really that unusual in places like Jharkhand. I know, for example, in 2023 to 2024, almost 90 people were killed there. And all across the country, around 600 people killed that same year. The thing that makes it unusual here is that we're talking about just one elephant. And authorities aren't really sure why it's acting so aggressively. But human-elephant conflict is just growing as a threat in many parts of India, regardless.
Why are these getting more common, as you say?
Well, it's largely because the forests are just being destroyed at higher rates. There's a lot of development projects. There's climate change. There's mining. And all in the same areas that the elephants are living. And so in Jharkhand especially, there's a lot of mining projects. Thousands of acres of forest lands have been destroyed. It's meant that 40% of India's minerals still come from that state, but it means that elephants are running out of places to go foraging for food.
Mm.
Yeah, so keep in mind, they need to eat hundreds of pounds of food each day just to live. Authorities have created some elephant corridors to help them get from one area of the forest to another, but these elephants still keep coming into contact with people, and that means more conflict.
So these elephants are forced out of the forest because their habitat and their food is being destroyed, and so they then come face to face with humans, and that's when there are these deaths.
Exactly.
So you've mentioned what the authorities are doing to respond to this. What about regular folks? Are they, you know, doing anything themselves to try to keep elephants at bay or keep themselves safe?
Well, this has just been so tough for people who live in areas where elephants also reside. People are afraid, especially the people who lost loved ones or have had loved ones injured in these encounters. Recently, I spent a few weeks in Andhra Pradesh, and that's a state in South India facing similar challenges. Here's one woman I spoke to, Chandrama. Here she's telling me that she'll watch over her field for two or three nights, only for an elephant to show up on the fourth night and destroy her crops, which is just a huge blow to people like her and other farmers. So that's why people are putting up electric fences, they're digging trenches, they're doing what they can to stop elephants from coming closer. But these things don't always work well, and sometimes they can end up killing the elephants.
Is there anything else that the government could or maybe should be doing to make this situation less dangerous, both for humans and elephants?
Experts tell me that Indian authorities are often too slow to respond to these attacks. If they moved a little more quickly in Jharkhand, for example, they might have prevented some of these deaths. In Jharkhand itself, they're working on this long-term plan for managing elephant populations, and they're trying to bring back parts of the forest. They're trying to better educate local communities. They're talking about a 10-year plan to address the problem, but it hasn't started yet.
Sounds like a long road ahead. Namrata Kalachalam reports from Mumbai, India. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A court in Greece has acquitted 24 rescue workers who were accused of smuggling migrants into the country. Sarah Mardini was one of the defendants. You might have seen her story on Netflix. The Swimmers is about her own escape from Syria with her sister, Yusra.
One day, I want to swim in the Olympics.
The conflict in Syria has escalated out of control.
The Syrian sisters headed toward Greece on a boat overcrowded with refugees. It started taking on water far from the shore. Because they were swimmers, Sarah and Yusra got off the boat and helped the other passengers safely to shore.
I was looking to everybody and seeing that we might die. And I knew if I want to make it, I'm going to make it. And then all the people on the boat, we believed that we're going to make it and we wanted to make it.
That's Sarah speaking to the world back in 2018, right after being released from prison in Greece on bail. At the time of her arrest, she was working as a volunteer for a now-defunct Greek nonprofit. It was helping migrants arriving on the island of Lesbos.
I was a search and rescue Arabic translator volunteer.
Mardini explained what she had been charged with.
Money laundering, spying on the state, being a member of criminal organization, using like a legal vehicle, and what else do I have? Smuggling refugees, trafficking humans, yeah, all these things together.
The case was condemned worldwide as an attempt to shut down migrant rescue operations. Mardini and her 23 co-defendants, who had worked at the same NGO as her, were acquitted of all charges yesterday. A criminal court in Lesbos determined that the volunteers were not trying to commit crimes, but rather provide humanitarian aid. Join us up next for a quest to recreate an unforgettable breakfast. You're with the world.
Right now, we are living through some of the most tumultuous political times our country has ever known. I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll try to make sense of what's happening, alongside politicians and thinkers like Cory Booker, Nancy Pelosi, Liz Cheney, Tim Walz, Ketanji Brown Jackson, Newt Gingrich, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Charlemagne the God, and so many more. That's all in the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Buehler. One of the very best things about traveling, obviously, is eating all of the new foods. Years ago, Istanbul-based reporter Fariba Nawa took her family to the Black Sea coast in Turkey. On that trip, she and her daughters fell in love with a savory breakfast food that they have never forgotten. But the quest to find the dish in Istanbul has proven tricky. Here's Fariba with that story.
It's a Sunday morning in my house. Everyone's just waking up. My girls, Banu Azizian and Andisha Azizian, don't like to get up on Sundays. Of course, they're teenagers.
Sobh bekhair, Banu.
Sobh bekhair.
How you feeling?
Tired.
That's my 17-year-old Banu.
What do you want to eat for breakfast?
Mohlama.
Mohlama. That's the dish we've been searching for the last 8 years. It's a cheesy, buttery, fondue-like delicacy cooked on high heat, consumed with fresh bread. The ultimate comfort food.
It has great oozing properties.
That's Turkish food expert and podcaster Aylin Onaytan.
So technically, we are talking about cheese, kind of like a semi-aged mozzarella, maybe, or something that really can be very oozy when heated. For breakfast, it's an easy preparation, but it could be like a fill-your-belly kind of thing in the afternoon, maybe tea time.
My kids and I want the same taste of the mohlama we had in 2018 in Artvin, a city tucked on the edge of the Kachkar Mountains on the Black Sea.
Hey, Andisha, kujai. Andisha? Chekar mikuni?
Araish migzaram.
Okay, Andisha's putting on her makeup. All right.
2 hours later, we're walking in our Istanbul neighborhood.
Chi khosh dari az mohlama? What do you like about mohlama?
I don't actually know what it is exactly. I just know it tastes good. That's it.
That's Andisha. She's 14.
Banu, what do you like about mohlama?
I like how it's cheesy and it stretches. It's like a grilled cheese sandwich, but just the grilled cheese. It's so bad for you, so it's perfect.
Andisha, Banu, and I have lived in Istanbul for the last 10 years. We moved here from California, where our Afghan-American family spoke a combination of Farsi and English. We still do. We've added Turkish to our lexicon. As outsiders, it's been hard to integrate in Turkey. But food is our way of connecting with different cultures. And mohlama tastes like acceptance. It's warm and comforting.
Merhabalar. Hoş bulduk. Ben gazeteciyim.
Our first stop is a disappointment. We go to a restaurant down the street in our neighborhood. I had seen mohlama on a menu, but the place has changed.
They have matcha instead now. It's really modernized.
Maybe you could get me something.
I'm really disappointed. Okay.
It seems like a really hip coffee place. We should go one someday, but not today.
Hip coffee places don't make mohlama. Traditional regional Turkish eateries might. So we keep walking and asking. We see a man digging a dead fish out of a garbage bin. We pop our heads in another restaurant, but they don't have mohlama either.
Maybe we should ask the old men and the old woman because they'll probably know the neighborhood better.
That's true. We've got to have mohlama in this neighborhood. Come on.
We don't find anything within walking distance. So the kids get online on their phones and find a restaurant called mohlama. It's 15 minutes by car, farther than I wanted to go. We hop in a cab. We arrive at the restaurant, famished. It has a Black Sea decor with wooden tables and chairs and panels on its ceiling. The scent of butter lingers.
This actually looks really cool. Okay, wait, I'm actually so excited. Turkish breakfast is one of the best things about Turkey.
The waiter seats us and hands us menus.
They have multiple kinds of mohlama.
Okay, can you explain what they are?
They have kavurmalı, which is like with meat. They have kaymaklı, which has, you know, kaymak.
It's cream.
Yeah, cream. Zeytin yağlı with olive oil.
We order the classic mohlama with olive oil instead of butter, and one with beef.
Böyle.
Böyle. Böyle. Tereyağı mı?
I joined the chef, Necda Aktaş, in the kitchen to watch her cook. When an order comes in, Aktaş turns on the gas stove to high heat, grabs a small pan, places it on the heat, then pours a ladle of butter. Add to that corn flour, a cup of water, liquefied cheese, and a pinch of salt. She stirs constantly. It's ready within minutes. Just like this, Aktaş says, sticking the pan under my nose so I can smell it. I get a whiff of a savory indulgence. The waiter brings the appetizers. Moist grape leaves stuffed with ground beef, thick creamy yogurt, and fluffy bread baked in a clay oven.
What are we drinking, girls?
I'm having karadut's juice. Their bread looks amazing.
Finally, the mohlama arrives sizzling in the copper pan.
Wait a minute.
It's oozing cheese.
The girls tear off a piece of bread and dip it in their long-awaited breakfast. The mohlama extends from the pan into their mouths.
Is it as good as the ones we had in the Black Sea?
No. Almost.
Wow, that's a lot of calories. It's good.
Afterwards, we all go into a food coma. But this was not the best mohlama. It wasn't as thick and rich as the one we had in 2018. It turns out the connection between mohlama and the Black Sea is specific.
Black Sea region is quite damp, rainy, and quite hilly as well. So it's not a region that's suitable for wheat cultivation.
That's Turkish food expert Une Tan.
So when corn made its way to Anatolia, they adopted corn in a way wholeheartedly because it was one of the staple foods that they could grow easily.
Could we find the mohlama taste we loved in Istanbul? A month later, One Tan invites me to a cheese tasting event at the Swiss Hotel in Istanbul. She says there might be mohlama there. Andisha's in school, but Banu's able to join me. We cross the Bosphorus to the European side of Istanbul on the speed bus. When we arrive, One Tan introduces us to many other food experts, and they point us toward the cheeses.
So this is just the right spot for everything related with cheese now.
We find fondue, but not mohlama. We meet food historian Özge Samanja and tell her about our search for the best mohlama. She teaches gastronomy at Özyeğin University in Istanbul.
Most of the time, local foods are best in their local area.
So I guess we're not going to find the best mohlama in Istanbul.
Maybe we can find some examples of best mohlama at homes, not outside in Istanbul.
Of course, we're disappointed. But there's something to be said for the connection between a place and its special foods. So our search for the authentic mohlama continues. For The World, I'm Fariba Nawa, Istanbul.
Coming up on the show, it is summer in Australia, which means wildfires. A new approach to communicating about the fires has made them less deadly in one state. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Fire crews in Australia are working to contain more than 30 fires in the southern part of the country. They've consumed an area larger than the state of Rhode Island. Most of the fires have been in the state of Victoria. As Chief Fire Officer Chris Hardman of Victoria's Forest Fire Management Agency told me, those crews are battling tough conditions.
We've had this very significant rainfall deficit for the last 19 months or so. In some of our provinces, we have seen sort of 50% less rain than we may have expected over a similar period. And that has led to extraordinarily dry conditions, particularly in our forested areas. But also we did have some early summer rain, and followed by the hot temperatures, we saw really excessive grass growth. We get these hot, dry northerly winds. And that combined with the dry fuels is the recipe we get for a very explosive fire behavior.
I understand that fire conditions have eased a bit in the last few days. Is that right? And if so, has that allowed firefighters, your crews, to contain the blazes somewhat?
We had a respite, so we've had much calmer conditions. That's given firefighters time to contain some of these fires. However, we have to track the edges of these fires with mineral earth breaks. And some of the edges of these fires, you know, there would be more than 600 kilometres.
Wow.
Of miles of track that we need to build. And then we need to do backburning operations or burning out operations to consolidate the edges of these fires before we can call them contained and then move forward.
Several hundred properties have been destroyed by these fires, and there has been one fatality, which is much fewer than the number of people who unfortunately died during Australia's Black Summer fires, 5 years ago, when 30 people died. Why is this season, you know, so much better in terms of fatalities?
Well, Australia's worst ever natural disaster was a wildfire, and that was in Black Saturday in 2009. Where 173 people were killed in Victoria. And the catastrophic conditions that we faced were very similar to 2009. And I think what has really changed is how we get information through to the community to enable community members to make more informed, better decisions. We don't have forced evacuations here in Australia. So we have emergency alerts. So we can text all of their phones. You know, if it's an evacuate message, we will say evacuate from this road if you're here, head to this town. And we're able to get that information into the hands of community members to enable them to make better decisions. Now, I was genuinely worried that we would have more fatalities. We've lost more than 700 structures. There's, you know, 256 homes and, you know, thousands of livestock loss, so cows and sheep. The impacts of these major fast-running wildfires are devastating for so many reasons. But the fact that we had such few fatalities has made all of the firefighters grateful.
Yeah. Can you tell me more about specifically what you changed about your communication since that very deadly fire back in 2009? Is it new that you can text people directly? Are you providing more specific targeted messaging?
Very targeted, very deliberate, very accurate messaging around the fire location and what it's going to do directly into the hands of community. We developed an app. It's called the Victorian Emergency Management App. And community members can set their watch zone, the area where they live or work, and they are informed. As soon as we get a fire ignition, that appears on their app. And if that's in proximity to them, they can start to think about what are their actions, what are they going to do next. And we have a levels of warning. So we have advice messages. Then we have a message which goes from advice to watch and act. And then beyond watch and act, we have an emergency warning. And when we have an emergency warning, that's we can then apply what we call an emergency alert, which is a text message that will be forced onto phones in a geographic area.
Chris, I want to ask you, you spoke very quickly about the large number of deaths back in 2009, and you're speaking with a lot of pride about the new strategies you're taking to reduce loss of life. Are those deaths something you think about a lot? Do they come back to you?
Yeah, they do. I've needed strong psychological support, so I've been doing this job for a very long time and it takes its toll, and as with many firefighters, and I'm the chief of an agency now, and after Black Saturday I couldn't go near fire for about 2 years. It was too painful for me. It just brought back too many memories, and reached out. I got a brilliant psychologist that supported me through helping me understand my feelings of what I was going through and what I experienced, and realised that it was quite normal for a human being to have that type of experience when you deal with such a traumatic event. And they helped me be able to manage those emotions and feelings, and to a point where I could come back into the fold. And I know how to manage that now, and can and focus on the things that have changed, focus on the things that we have done differently, focus on the lessons that we've taken to do better, to keep our community safe.
Does this work you've done on your own mental health and coming to grips with what you saw and experienced, does that inform how you lead your agency?
It shapes the way I lead, and firefighter safety is the most important thing. You know, in the 2020 bushfires, three of my team were killed. So I have a very strong focus on making sure that firefighters have really good situational awareness, they have access to the best information about where the fire is, what it's going to do, and that they are not in harm's way.
I appreciate you talking about this aspect of your work. Chris, what is the forecast for the rest of the season? What are you guys expecting?
Look, it's still early in our summer period, so we would expect to see more extreme fire weather. The season is still challenging, and we will do everything we can to keep fire small, because if you keep it small, that reduces the risk to firefighters, the community, the environment, and our critical infrastructure in Victoria.
Chris Hardman is Forest Fire Management Chief in Victoria, Australia. Millions of people with tuberculosis are unaware that they carry it. Getting more people diagnosed is crucial to stopping the spread of the disease. Recent scientific breakthroughs could improve rapid TB tests, and that could transform care in India, where more people have TB than anywhere else in the world. Chavi Sachdev brings us this story from Mumbai, India.
In 2017, Ashna Ashish noticed swelling in her lymph nodes. Ashna is a lawyer in Patna, a city in eastern India. When she went to the doctor, they suspected and diagnosed tuberculosis. Ashna couldn't believe her bad luck.
I wasn't really in contact with anybody who had tuberculosis, but yeah, it's airborne, so it can happen to anyone who breathes. It's like COVID that way, so.
Ashna was given the standard treatment, a steady dose of antibiotics, which in most cases clears up the bacterial infection in 6 months. But after many months of antibiotics, she wasn't getting any better. More tests revealed some devastating news. Her tuberculosis, or TB for short, was drug resistant.
Honestly, I remember the day I got the diagnosis for the resistant TB and that I'd have to be on treatment for 2 years. And I was looking at maybe getting a master's in public health. All of that kind of just disappeared and I had no idea what's going to happen. It was very bleak.
Ashna is now an advocate for TB survivors and a public health professional. She's one of the lucky ones who had access to good health care. Around the world, close to 11 million people fall ill with TB every year. India leads the world in global TB cases. And the disease continues to claim lives at a staggering rate.
1.5 million people die of TB every year globally. Of these, about 26-27%, you know, are in India alone.
This is Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, the principal advisor for India's National Tuberculosis Elimination Program.
So we have a very large burden both of TB and TB deaths in India.
What's even more astonishing is that nearly a quarter of those infected with TB go undiagnosed. In fact, 40% of all Indians have what's known as latent tuberculosis, meaning they are carriers but are unaware they have the disease. Getting that diagnosis isn't straightforward. For a number of reasons, people are reluctant to get tested. Many would rather just treat the symptoms with cough medicine. This is because TB means social ostracism, isolation, unemployment, and even lowered marriage prospects.
In India, the questions that get asked are around marriage. If they're already married, there are cases where in-laws have sort of distanced themselves from the daughter-in-law, and that's usually problematic. If you're LGBTQI++, then there are typically very quick judgments about lifestyle that are made that, oh, this is probably what caused it.
The perhaps most alarming form of stigma comes from healthcare professionals.
Sometimes doctors may not physically examine patients.
Even when you do find a doctor willing to test and treat TB, the traditional methods can fall short. Sometimes the tests are just not available. And collecting samples can be difficult too, says Dr. DJ Christopher. He's a professor and clinical researcher specializing in TB at Christian Medical College, Vellore, a top-ranked medical college in India.
There are some people that are not able to cough up sputum, although they have symptoms of TB such as cough, fever, weight loss, etc. But sputum sample is required for diagnosis, and they are not able to produce it.
When patients can't produce enough sputum during their visit, they are often sent home with a specimen bottle and told to return the next day. This back and forth can be too burdensome for some, and Dr. Christopher says many times patients don't come back at all. Treatment is also challenging, often involving 6 months of daily medication. Compliance is low, and many people stop taking the medicine when they start feeling better. This not only makes the infection linger, but also results in a widespread problem of antibiotic resistance. The TB bacterium has mutated enough that many resistant infections do not respond to first-line antibiotics. Given all these challenges, Dr. Christopher says it's critical that the medical community evolves.
Till recently, the backbone of TB diagnosis was sputum microscopy, which had not changed for over 100 years.
The good news is now there's something called a PCR test, which stands for polymerase chain reaction. It's a rapid molecular test that works by quickly identifying the presence of TB DNA in a person's sputum. A PCR test is more sensitive, which means even a small sample can yield a result, and it's faster, producing results in just a few hours rather than days. Some tests can also tell if the TB is resistant to certain antibiotics, which helps patients start the right treatment sooner. To move diagnostics along, Dr. Christopher and his international colleagues have formed a collaborative.
This is where R2D2 steps in to throughput novel diagnostics by quality research.
In this case, R2D2 is not Luke Skywalker's droid. Rather, the acronym stands for Rapid Research in Diagnostics Development. Basically, this means that they work with researchers and labs around the world who are pioneering new techniques to diagnose TB quickly.
R2D2 is an initiative that addresses this important need to ensure that diagnostic development is accelerated from prototype all the way through to policy.
The R2D2 TB network links promising new researchers and tools to 10 clinical sites around the world and then tests their diagnostic tools with larger sample sizes using WHO standard protocols.
R2D2 helps researchers and supports national programs and the WHO in developing policies. It does so by providing the evidence that is needed for making policies which will eventually benefit people.
Several prototypes have been tested and many have not made the cut. Dr. Christopher says one tool that they have been testing for the last few years holds a lot of potential. A new technique which would replace sputum tests with tongue swabs. Dr. Swaminathan agrees.
Non-sputum-based test like a tongue swab could be a game changer because it would allow a person to test themselves. It would be fantastic to have something like that. Then you could imagine actually going out and testing everyone in the community.
What makes the new test so exciting is partly the speed, it's a rapid result, and the simplicity of using a tongue swab means you're more likely to get patients to test, including children, the elderly, and immunocompromised people who have difficulty producing sputum. Dr. Christopher and his R2D2 TB network colleagues just released significant findings about the potential of tongue swab-based TB tests. In a new study published in eBiomedicine, two novel swab-based tools were compared to routine sputum tests in India, Uganda, and Vietnam. The results showed both swab-based tests were more sensitive than the traditional sputum tests.
It is very promising.
The tongue swab-based TB tests that they evaluated were MTB Ultima and Minidoc MTB. MTB Ultima comes from an Indian company called Malbio Diagnostics, and Minidoc MTB was developed by PlusLife, which is based in China. In another unpublished paper, they showed that patients also prefer swabs to the sputum test by more than a 3-to-1 margin.
Tongue swab is a novel sampling technique, and people do not perceive any stigma to this. It could also be deployed as a community screening tool.
The swabs, which use PCR technology to find the DNA of TB, are also easily deployed because these new swab-based testing devices are simpler and cheaper than current devices that test sputum. Plus, these battery-operated devices can analyze both the tongue swabs and sputum, enabling more patients to get tested. They're so easy to use, people could potentially test themselves someday. Ashna Ashesh, the TB survivor turned public health advocate, is very much encouraged by all these innovations, but her work on the ground has taught her that the key to success for any new treatment is implementation. To that end, she's working hard to keep patients' needs front and center.
I think innovation is fantastic and it's very, very needed. The only question, regardless of the kind of technology that I'd be interested in, is it human-centered design, which means are you bringing in impacted communities while you're designing it? Is it actually meeting real-world needs that impacted communities are facing? Is it affordable? Is it accessible? And is it high quality?
Dr. Christopher says the tools they develop will be scalable and hopefully more affordable. Currently, sputum tests cost around 2,400 rupees or $27. The new swab-based tests may wind up costing less than that. As more product developers join in and trials expand, the impact could go global. With enough funding and cooperation, the doctors and researchers that make up the R2D2 TB network are increasingly optimistic that the goal of global elimination of TB is within reach.
Chavi's story originally aired on The Threshold, a new podcast from Foreign Policy about how to end infectious diseases. And up next on The World, a childhood memory bottled up and sold. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Ruby Chan grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. She loved the feeling of lots of cultures all thrown together in one place. It smelled like bagels and bialys outside of Jewish delis and espresso and garlic one block over in Little Italy. But this story is about how Ruby connected to her own culture in that part of New York City.
In the middle of it all was my Chinatown. Hanging ducks in the windows, fish in tanks. That's where I found love with food, flavor, and freshness. That was the community that raised me. My parents, Yam and Eva, came here with engineering degrees, but no one would hire them. So, like most immigrants, they started all over. And eventually, they were chopping vegetables and sweeping floors and working harder than anybody else in the room. They started their own restaurant, a tiny Chinese restaurant in Clifton, New Jersey. That place became everything to us. It was the business. It was the family. It was my after-school program. But instead of soccer practice, I was answering phones, folding dumplings, doing math homework next to the box of fortune cookies. But what I remember so vividly was my dad's ginger scallion sauce. Bright, bold topping that he served with pan-fried dumplings. Nothing fancy whatsoever, but it was magic. Customers begged to take it home. And I would say to him, "Dad, I think you should shut the restaurants down and just sell sauce." He looked at me and said, "Ruby, head down, stop talking, work harder." And that was just the rule in the house. Don't dream, just hustle. My dad died young at the age of 52. And after finishing up my MBA at Bentley, the restaurant had been sold. I swore I would never, ever do what my parents did. I wanted a corporate office job. I wanted a desk. And I definitely did not want to smell like beef and broccoli. I traded in dumplings for deadlines, and for 25 years, I worked in marketing, managing campaigns, leading teams, checking off all the right boxes. But with four kids, tuition, expectations stacked high, it was hard. I was burnt out on all ends. I would come home, and most nights, I would feel like I was on a real episode of Chopped, where the mystery ingredient was whatever's in the fridge and how much time before someone cries. But one night, I came home totally wiped, and I just threw together what I knew, ginger, scallion, a little bit of oil, and poured it on top of chicken. We sat down, and for once, it was quiet. No one was crying, asking what was for dessert. Then my daughter, Kayla, looked up and said, "Mom, you should bottle this." I froze. All of a sudden, I was no longer in my kitchen anymore. I was back at the restaurant, hearing my own voice from all those years ago. I knew what I had to do then. So I quit my job, no business plan, no investors, just my stove, my sauce, and a little girl who knew it was special. I started from scratch, pitching it one jar at a time to whoever would take a sample or just feel too guilty to say no to me. Then, my first lifeline, I found an incubator kitchen in Boston. I finally had the right tools, guidance, and a community. Immigrant mothers, women, all turning their stories into something you can taste. They looked at me, about to pour 400 degrees oil on top of ginger and scallion, and said, "Okay, love the flavor, but if you keep doing that, we're calling the fire department." They helped me scale and believe that I had a shot. But it was still hard, still really messy. Like my first big retail moment. I had packed the car with care, drove to Needham like I was headed to the Oscars. But my jars failed me. The lids busted open and there was sauce everywhere. The seats, the seams, my soul. I pulled the car over, took a moment, cleaned up the mess, and just kept going. Because giving up just wasn't an option. But the worst critic of them all, my mother. She would look me in the eye and say, "Okay, Ruby, I did not come to this country to work my fingers raw, to raise you, to get an education, just to watch you sweep floors." I get it. She was totally traumatized by the restaurants, the stress, the struggle, and she didn't want me to go back to work she worked so hard to leave. I was scared too, but what Kayla had sparked in me was stronger than fear. So at that point, I just knew that this was no longer a hustle. It was a calling. And now, every time I make that sauce, I feel connected to my dad, who never had a chance to see this dream come true, to my daughter, who reminded me of who I am, and to that little New Jersey kitchen where it all began. Thank you.
Ruby Chan is the founder of Fresh Zen, selling Asian sauces by the jar, including garlic scallion. She told her story as part of GBH's live Stories from the Stage program in Boston. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find more of our original reporting on YouTube. Subscribe to our channel there. It's called The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you so much for listening and have yourself a great weekend.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.